Oh my God, in Ireland, they've
Yeah, in
just gone
Ireland,
completely
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah, they're even worse
I
in
haven't seen my
Canada.
family in like a year and a half or something. I was supposed to go home and when this whole thing started, it's just insane. Like my poor parents are just like trapped in this house and they're not allowed to leave like within 5 kilometers.
Yeah, it's
It's
Jesus.
unbelievable. But the Irish political class are the most servile. I mean, in the world, they're just if whatever the EU says, they go 10 times further. They go out of their way to be the most obedient political class in the world, and they're doing it with this as well. If they're supposed to do a lockdown, they do a 10 times harder lockdown. And I mean, this is I have a totally half-baked. Probably not very well worked out theory of this, but I do think it's a sort of it's a product of kind of like colonial economics in a way, whereby basically, in some sense, Ireland has never become a normal country, right? There's partition in the north. It never really developed. There was a very good attempt, but it never fully got to develop a kind of an indigenous like industrial economy. There's a couple of reasons for that. There's a very good trade union economist called Michael Taft who's written kind of about why that is. Some of the reasons were a bit mundane. They were just sort of global forces that conspired against them. But also, it was such a young country, and then suddenly the 90s happens basically, right? And everyone's decided, oh, actually, national economics are all wrong, and we need to just financialize everything. And whoops, I'm sorry.
No stress, no stress.
And so they just basically create this economy based on low corporation tax. They bring in all the big tech companies there to just like run their finances through the country. And that's their economic model. And of course now, in order to oversee that, they've got this, I must be one of the biggest per capita NGO sectors in the developed world. So it's a country that is not sovereign economically, culturally, intellectually, in any way. And it's basically just a like a parking lot for, international finance, capital, and tech, and so on. As a result, the political class are just extra servile. They know that they don't have. They know that their economy is totally at the mercy of these international forces. Like if some other country, for example, somehow manages to find an even lower corporation tax. I think Apple were paying 0.02%. So maybe some country will go to 0.01 or 0.001 or something. But yeah, the whole economy will just be destroyed. And anyone who tries to even talk about it in Ireland is sort of treated like they're some relic. Who just doesn't understand how the world works now, but like, there has to be a serious discussion about the crash that will happen.
Yeah, it's
If
gonna be bad.
yeah, really bad. But it has to happen eventually because,
Yeah.
the as I say, the political class are just, I think that is the root, that they're the fact that they are totally at the mercy of all of these forces. And also, I think Irish people to some extent internalize the idea that when you reflect back to these international forces what they want to hear, money falls from the sky, basically, whether it's the EU or, the kind of big tech or whatever, you get little rewards, not much, but from if you go along with whatever the prevailing like project of the day is, if you can prove that you are willing to be the best pupil in all of Europe or whatever, that's their model. That's basically they have no interest in, like, the idea that they are just servants of the voters or something is totally absurd.
Well, I think that to draw on something you were saying, Angela, the Irish capitalism was always a very rather sickly creation. And the Irish capitalist class, I mean, they had to be shoved into even striving for independence from the British Empire. I think that the Irish bourgeois, such as that they did exist before 1920, didn't. I think they were the class that was the least keen on an independent Ireland. And when they were able to politically reassert themselves after partition, you saw that in the terms of, like, the political struggle that did go on. I mean, Eamon de Valera had a lot of problems with his approach to things, but he at least did try to do, like, import substitution, some degree of industrialization, all of which basically falls apart, I think, as you were saying. And they, for a long time, they were still the Irish ruling class was still subject to the whims of British capital, and then they traded that up for essentially the whims of, like, American and German capital, really. And so they've just traded in one block for another.
Yeah, no, there's a really interesting, Conor McCabe is an Irish economist who's written in a really interesting way about this, the kind of distorted class nature of the Irish economy. It's interesting too. I've been reading recently about the flight of the earls. Like, Ireland, the Gaelic Ireland, basically lost its aristocracy, and then you have this weird with the British Empire. You have this, like, very distorted economy in which Ireland is, like, a beef and, like, food producer essentially, for export. And there's an economist called Raymond Crotty who is he was a farmer actually, but he wrote about the kind of imperial economics and the economics of colonies and kind of what comes after empire, and he documented a lot of this and, like, explained why the class structure of Ireland is very distorted and weird as a result. But yeah, that's I mean, I feel terrible for every time I talk to people from home, it's just absolute misery. The lockdown has been really, really, really strict.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in Ontario and it's been really bad here, but, something I was wondering about, because, I went to Ireland a few years ago actually, and I found that the consciousness of the history of Irish struggle against British imperialism and the sacrifices that the Irish were forced to make at the hands of British imperialism was still very much alive within, you know, just your average person, and in a way that isn't so with Canadians, for instance. Well, because we have a completely different history, but how have you seen that history kind of express itself during this pandemic? And, you know, as Ireland has been increasingly pressed under the thumb of American finance capital, like, how are you finding the history of the vibrant history of Irish working class struggle expressed today?
Well, this is a funny thing, right? Because Irish sort of managerial elites, I guess, mm-hmm. the kind of people who read the Irish Times and stuff like that, they don't like Sinn Féin, they don't like republicanism. But they also want to try to, in a way, like, create their own form of, like, liberal national ruling class identity, I guess. And so they know that they can't just completely dispense with, like, the founding, you know, revolutionaries of the country, basically, and the whole, like, you know, you can't quite do that. So instead, they've created this kind of, basically what they ended up doing in the 90s, when there was when the Celtic Tiger came after the economy was restructured for the finance capital and low corporation tax and so on, is they try to treat it in a way like a national win. Like, you know, look, you know, they mm-hmm. said we couldn't create our own economy. Like, look at us now, you know, everyone is buying property and, you know, the GDP is high and everything's going great. So they kind of almost have this idea that, like, this was Ireland sort of finally finally becoming modern, you know. So mm-hmm. it is funny, though, because everyone has to, even if you're like a total liberal, anti-Sinn Féin type of person, Irish Times sort of person, you still have to in some way defer to the national mythology. In some ways, because it's all that's there, you know, like but they have a problem then, because of course the revolutionaries were like James Connolly, who's a Marxist, and you know, all the rest were really just like straightforwardly nationalists. So how do you mix that with your weird plan, your plan for kind of a totally hyper globalized economy? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what they've come up with. It's this weird kind of cosmopolitanism that somehow is also a little bit about national pride.
It's tough for, I mean, Canada is also technically colonized. Well, this is again, I don't know, there's not a parallel with Ireland, but like just due to the different histories. But I find that in Canada, because of the lack of advanced industry here, and maybe this speaks to the Irish case, I find that our politics are very anemic. Like, the politicians here and the left here especially just basically imports things from the United States in contexts, even though the context is completely different. So they'll try to import American race politics into Canada when we have different demographics, we have a different history of slavery, you know, mostly a lack thereof. And we also just have different ethnic dynamics, which have played a bigger role in Canada than what happened between the African slaves and the white colonists in America. Like, we have a big issue around indigenous people here. We have the French versus English divide, which has been historically extremely important. But they just try to import things and try to, you know, apply it awkwardly, you know, in a context which
That stuff is definitely the new, because American culture is no longer able to produce like a really vital kind of counterculture like it did in the 60s. Or even before that, I suppose, like if you think of like, you know, the kind of like rebel without a cause type of thing, like America used to produce this like very, very captivating sort of like counterculture, I guess, or popular culture that, you know, was its kind of soft power around the world. But now, I mean, there's nothing in popular culture that anyone really wants to replicate. There's no, like, if you think of music, movies and stuff like that. So this stuff is what is the new soft power, undoubtedly, you know, and it just amazingly just appears everywhere. I mean, you know, even in places like, you know, there were BLM marches in places where there's no black people, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, it's amazing.
Well, speaking of the depravity of art, I really wanted to get your thoughts on this, actually, because you're the first person I heard this from when I was listening to a show you did with What's Left. And you just made a comment which really struck me, where you said that beauty is increasingly unavailable to anyone but the bourgeoisie, so but the ruling class. And I think, you know, in Ireland for sure, Canada, the UK, we've seen major shutdowns of museums and orchestras and other venues of culture, which, although, yes, many of these are not accessible to the working classes, I do feel cutting people off from their human heritage. So art and culture is an assault. So, I mean, as a Marxist, I do tend to to take on the Marxist kind of didactic view of art, meaning that art is meant to help people find the truth. So it's supposed to play an educational role, which is why I think that the separation of people from the ability to access culture and art has been so bad, is such a bad assault. But I guess, like, you know, you've done some thinking about it, and with the you know, this kind of ultimate withdrawal of art from the public, the access of the public, or the public's ability to access this, like, how do you think that's what kind of effects that has that have, and, you know, has that changed your
During the riots, when, like, a lot of statues were coming down and stuff, wasn't there a statue outside of the it was one of the big museums in New York, but I remember thinking, because everything was so crazy at that time, like, I was thinking, my God, what if they go into the museum? because the thing is, I thought, you know, if you say that, I spoke to people about it at the time, just friends and stuff, and they said, no, that would never happen because the art is worth so much money. But then I was like, yeah, but who's running the museum? Like, who, there's apparently nobody who's going to ever say at any point, like, no, we can't just, like, cancel Michelangelo or something, you know? because the people who are running the whole, like, bureaucracy, I guess, around the arts, around the public arts, are now all ideologues like this. So at a certain point, they have to agree with the idea that the art that they are there to manage or something, the art that they're there to preserve, we'll say, is actually evil and fascist, you know. So that's really worrying. I was kind of thinking, maybe this stuff should be moved to Russia or something. I don't know. it's not safe in America
freedom
anymore. But anyway, I was going to write that, and then I thought, oh, I don't want to give them any ideas. I don't want to plant this idea in the head of one of these crazy people who's going to run in and start throwing paint all over the fascist artwork. It's not actually fascist, obviously, but, you know, yeah, but I guess, like, this kind of, okay, so I mentioned that thing about Marxism today earlier. There was this, with the kind of new left, there was this rejection, you know, they wanted to reject a lot of things about the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And part of that was that in some way, like under Stalin, there had been this cultural reactionary turn, and they wanted to, you know, part of the kind of Cold War Western left soft power kind of project was to create, like, youth culture and counterculture and very opposed to anything, you know, like, I haven't read this stuff in so long, but didn't Trotsky write about how, like, the you know, you should basically preserve the best of bourgeois culture?
Yeah. It was I think that's in his, the collected works on literary criticism.
That's right. Yeah. And he made a very good argument for that, you know, and which is one that I would agree with, which is, like, that, you know, the idea, the dream is that high culture is available to everyone, not that you destroy the best of culture and you make everyone just be, as I said, writing a PhD about The Simpsons, like, you know, this, like, crap kind of, just middle brow culture, but also, you know, what remains of the best of high culture is often only accessible to elites, which is why it's so infuriatingly hypocritical that they try to cut it off for everyone else, you know, like, you know, so the same people who will talk about how, you know, who will talk about, like, who will denigrate, like, say, people wanting their local town or something to be quaint looking, right? Like, that's a common thing. Most people like that. Those same people will live in a Georgian house in the city, you know, or you know, and if you go into these kind of neighborhoods where people who are not just wealthy, but kind of have a lot of cultural prestige live, they're often places that have preserved old forms of architecture. They're often places that are near the great museums. You know, even I'm just thinking of in Dublin, another thing I share with Peter Hitchens is my love of trains. and in Dublin, one of the most beautiful tram services is this thing called the DART, which goes right along the coast. And it basically connects all the wealthiest seaside, beautiful Dublin neighborhoods to the city. Right. So the people who need public transport the least have the most scenically beautiful tram service in the country. Mm-hmm. You know, it connects all these places like Dunleary and so on. So these people, right, they live in these beautiful, preserved old forms of architecture. They have access to natural beauty because they get to live in these really high property value places where you can look out over the sea or whatever. But then they're ideologues against cultural elitism in a sense as well, you know, like because they prefer, you know, the modern to kind of, you know, what remains of the kind of aristocratic culture and so on. So that is just a kind of general hypocrisy that annoys me, you know, because they will denigrate this kind of phantom of tradition, but still preserve the nice bits for themselves while cutting it off for everyone else, because they'll say, no, that's actually this, you know, this painting, you know, or this depiction of the human body is fascistic or something. I mean, this, you know, because even when I said I was going to write about this, I think I mentioned on that podcast, the first response of leftists was like, oh, that'll sound fascist if you say that. And then I thought, right, okay, so wait, if you're so you're saying that elites can have access to beauty, ordinary people can't, and if you have anything bad or critical to say about that, that's fascism.
Yeah. Yeah, what I found especially insulting for me is in this whole kind of discourse is the erasure of the contribution of the oppressed classes to art. Whether you think it's elite or not or whatever, these pieces of art wouldn't have been able to be produced if it wasn't for the oppressed classes. And it belongs to them as well. And it's not up to someone to say, you can't enjoy this, you can't enjoy this. Like, I think we can understand things, contextualize them, and through that process, make people more intelligent, help them develop their cultural. Yeah, like, I don't, this is such an obvious thing to me, and it's really annoying to hear people like disagree with it. But also, like, I think what the bourgeoisie did this time around too is that they were like, okay, well, you got to stay home because it's safe and whatever, and you can't go to museums anymore, but here's an electronic version of the museum. And they want to pretend as if access to electronic art is just as good as the real thing, you know? Like, and I just find that this substitution that they would make for the proletariat, but definitely not for themselves. Like, they want to go to see a real life orchestra, and they want to go to, they have pieces of art in their homes, and they surround themselves with beauty and with human heritage. But they don't think anyone else should have access to that. And so I think they think that an electronic version, this depraved binary, the version that's based on a binary code is good enough. And I just find that it's a very anti-human way of looking at art, you know, like it, you know, like mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. I mean, I just imagine it. Like, I got all those emails from, you know, I'm subscribed to way too many email lists. But, you know, yeah, I got those things saying, oh, you can come and look at a painting in our museum electronically. But it's like, yeah, but I could just Google the image.
Yeah.
This doesn't make any sense.
There's something to be said about going to a museum and experiencing art with people around you. And there's no camera that can meet the acuity of the human eye.
Yeah.
It's not possible. Yeah, for so many reasons. And so to say it's just the same thing, to say that attending a wedding over Zoom is just as good as the real thing, for instance. Only the bourgeoisie could say something like this.
You know? Yeah. And, you know, it is really, it is, it's a thing that I do associate with the Blair vision as well, which is like, you know, I think in many ways, like that period, the Blair period, it did a lot to create what we now call the bug man. You know what I mean? And the culture of like, you know, somebody who appreciates design and who maybe has like creates websites or has some kind of a creative economy type of job like that. But it's this weird aesthetic as if like the whole history of art never existed, you know what I mean? And it's just all sort of design, like it's just sort of not even industrial design, but like you know, in interior design almost, and kind of web design and stuff like that. That's their kind of aesthetic. But also, you know, this whole thing of like which is really just the whole, it's been there since the beginning of the New Left, really. The substitution of cultural anti-elitism for anything economic is sort of how they give themselves legitimacy, right? Because only a snob would be interested in like cultural heritage, and they can't see themselves as a snob because they go into work wearing their sandals, and they, you know, they have a tech job, and they're like no collar workers and stuff. Like that's their whole self-conception. So they do see themselves as anti-elitists, you know, and so therefore they want to just erase kind of the heritage of high culture. But then like, what does everyone else have? You know, I mean, if you look at how dead the culture is now, I mean, do they really think that like, just, I don't know, TikTok and, you know, even pop culture itself, the extent to which it has declined in recent years is really remarkable. Like, if you look through something like Netflix, you know, just like the standard of what was there, even 10 or 20 years ago, you know, if you look at like the big HBO dramas or whatever, like there still was like genuinely good work being produced in some way, you know, and it's just gone now. There's absolutely nothing. I mean, I was thinking for a while about, you know, at a certain point you get exhausted with politics and you kind of think, well, remember when we used to listen to music and read books and novels and, you know, it's just like been totally erased from our lives. But then you go back, you go and you look at the culture section in the newspaper or something, and you think, oh my God, I don't want to go back to culture. This is horrible. This is even worse than politics. Because it's just absolute garbage, you know, just totally, you know, like, oh, a novel, oh, like, here's the latest, you know, 22-year-old who's written a novel about being non-binary or something. and you know, and it's so, what's amazing too is I'd love to see the sales figures on some of these things, because it just looks so artificially inflated. Like, I just think, who is reading this, you know? And where are the even remotely serious people, like, anywhere in the arts, you know? There's a reason we're ignoring it. It's because it's so bad now. Or maybe it's so bad because we're ignoring it. I don't know.
Well, I think it's the deep cultural rot, to my mind, like, has been... It's been growing under the surface, but it's really manifested itself in the last decade in this country. Even just something as basic as like what new buildings are put up in terms of housing, which is of course linked to half a dozen dozens of other factors as well. But like even like the design of like, I've lived in some of these places, so I know like the design of like new flats in Manchester. It's like this. It's this surface level sort of shiny glass. Postmodern design with like the interior of like the actual living spaces is all very built with very, very cheap materials, very crumbles and decays very, very quickly and has to be replaced within about 10 years. And that's like obviously a reflection of like the desire for rapid and high returns on like quite cheap investments. in the building sector, but it's also like an expression on a cultural level of a system which has just run out of ideas. It's just like this pastiche of past styles stuck together very cheaply with the full expectation that it's going to fall down inside a decade. And that's not just accommodation. That's like some of the big building projects of like the Blair era, in terms of what they were, the public buildings they were putting up, all displayed all the same things. It's like this shiny glass aesthetic, this like postmodern design. As a building in Manchester, they call it the filing cabinet. It's the Ministry of Justice Civil Service building. But you go inside and past this like sort of odd collection of oblongs, which is the exterior of it. You go inside and it's all dirty, it's all falling apart, it all looks like it's been there for about 30 years when it's only been there about 15. And it's the very spaces that the system is now building for itself look dirty and cheap and compromised, because it's the creativity in the system, I think, has gone, and that reflects itself everywhere. So I think it's all aspects of the culture are going down with a system which can't overcome its contradictions anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like it's run out. It's very hard to imagine it being, even on the level of culture, things like that, architecture and so on, it's very hard to imagine it being able to revive itself in any way, you know. Because even in the economic sphere, you can kind of paper over things to an extent by just sort of artificial financial bookkeeping, basically. But in a way, the cultural sphere kind of is more telling, because that's something that you can't hide the lack of dynamism, and you can't really, you know, it's something that simply can't be it can't be artificially created, you know.
Yeah, and I think because the ruling class needs culture and art, like it requires it to. As part of its means of running society. And so it's interesting to see it struggle to produce things to give to the masses, and like, you know, through Netflix and stuff, and it's so bad. And like, it puts out so much, like there's so much quantity, but the quality of it is so bad. As it's struggling to figure out a way of keeping up its ideological production without this the dynamism from the working classes to invigorate the system and you know, put in that contradiction, and from contradiction comes new synthesis and innovation, right? So yeah, like I think they're really struggling here, and you know, it's and their substitutions are becoming worse and worse. Like I thought that the substitution of, like, you know, electronic museums instead of real museums during the pandemic, for instance, was probably pretty much like the bottom of the barrel, but it could go even worse.
Yeah, I think Camille Paglia used to write about how even in pop culture, like, you know, you know, that it was actually a popular medium in the sense of the people actually creating it, not like the producers and whatever, but the actual artists, you know. And that's true. Like, really, that was true even for actors, for musicians and stuff like that in the 60s, maybe up to the, I don't know exactly when it changed, maybe the 80s or something, but. But that's not true anymore, which is one of the reasons why, like, she used to say that a lot of movies that portray working class life are very, don't feel right, or don't feel like they don't really work anymore, because the actual actors playing them are these like bubble children, right, who've been like raised to be actors their entire lives and who've gone through drama school and stuff like that, whereas like even in like the best days of cinema, you actually had actors whose own lives were kind of similar to the ones that they were portraying. Yeah, but then Helen Andrews has written this book about boomers, and she has this critique of Paglia in there, which is essentially saying that, among other things, that she made this mistake of thinking that popular culture could kind of be the new high culture in a way, or not seeing that it would run out of steam so fast. And it certainly does feel like it's run out of steam. As I say, I simply can't imagine a revival that they were able to pull off in the kind of Cold War period, where they needed this really vital counterculture. It's very hard to see them coming up with anything like that now, you know. Anything like that in terms of quality. Obviously, the new version is wokeness, basically. But that's just, you know, like, even if you go back and look at the kind of best of, like, 60s, you know, counterculture and stuff like that, you know, you can really see why it was so captivating. Like, it's very easy to see, or even look at, like, Elvis or something, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. You can see why, to the eyes and ears of people at that time, it must have been just totally mesmerizing. Whereas nobody can say anything like that today about pop culture now, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think maybe one of the best albums ever created is A Love Supreme by Coltrane. And that was a piece of pop culture, right? And yeah, I mean, I think you're kind of touching on something that me and Alex have talked a lot about the effects of the Soviet Union and kind of pushing forward a lot of this stuff. Like, it kind of forced the United States and the rest of the capitalist world to really mount an opposition, you know, which I think played into a lot of the innovation that we saw during that era. And so, yes, I do think it's difficult to see how something will reemerge without such a challenge. But of course,
what about China, though, as a kind of, I know it's not the same, but as a big power competition, kind of. There is this idea. Ari Roussinas has written this piece in Unheard, which is kind of suggesting that basically the reason that the rise of China will reshape policy in the West, and that it will create this kind of turn away from neoliberalism, but that will still kind of imitate certain. That will imitate certain aspects of China in order to rival it, kind of, in a way, which is kind of terrifying, because that made me think, are they going to imitate, like, what are they going to create a Western alternative to? Well, they have, actually, right? They're already kind of doing it, right? Creating a Western version of just, like, surveillance and monitoring people online and rewarding and punishing them and so on.
Well, I think on the China question, the reality is that China's becoming more like, in certain aspects, Western capitalism. And Western capitalism is trying to copy certain aspects that it thinks are very successful from China, because China being the rising capitalist power now. But I think that what's actually going on, I mean, the idea that the great power competition will revive to a certain degree inward investment in Britain or the United States, I think that they're talking about that. Certainly it's a talking point in certain aspects of the ruling class. But I think also, like, at a time when, like, the Cold War with the USSR was taking place, not only was the USSR a fundamentally different system, no matter what your opinion might be of it, and a fundamentally different system to the American system, whereas the current modern Chinese system explicitly is inspired by many aspects of capitalism in Britain and the United States and the rest of the advanced capitalist world. So we're already dealing with, I think, a different material basis. And also, post-World War II, American capital had much more juice to it than it does now. It went through a long and very successful boom period after 1945. I don't think that it has the capacity for that now. And certainly, like, everything they've tried since 2008 hasn't worked. Layla and I discussed this a lot, the idea that we have a version now of what Lenin was describing as state monopoly capital. That's grown and grown and grown, whereby the barriers between, like, the capitalist state in the United States and private capital now are increasingly blurred to the point of not existing, and that they exist only in really illusory terms. But also, China can't escape going down the same road, no matter how much state intervention they still have. They're still going down similar paths to other capitalist powers. They're still looking to attract finance capital into the country. They're still going down the path of progressively privatizing state-owned enterprises. And of course, they're being pushed and are pushing themselves down the path to becoming an imperialist power. So this is, I think we're dealing with a different form of great power competition, and we're also dealing with an American and British capitalist systems, and, you know, French and German by extension, that have a lot less juice to them than they did in 1945. And also that the Chinese represent something fundamentally different to what the USSR was in the immediate post-war period.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. And also the Chinese system, it may kind of force the technocrats in the West to start thinking in this way. Whether they will act on that is another thing, but it's not the same in the sense that, you know, the Cold War kind of left in the West understood, or the people who created the Cold War left in the West understood that, you know, that the Soviet Union and that communism all over the world sort of had this ideological power to it, you know. And I don't think that there's an equivalent of that with China, you know. So, like, in other words, the idea of communism was something that they had to, the creators of the totally fake Cold War New Left, they knew that they had to rival something that was powerful, right? That was really potent and that inspired people. Whereas, like, nobody's really inspired by the Chinese system. Like, it doesn't inspire their passions, you know what I mean? so it doesn't have to be fought on that level, or it doesn't have to be rivaled on that level. But I'm sure it will have some, the emergence of it will all the same, you know, I'm sure the technocrats are thinking about it, right? And they're at least thinking about the idea that maybe totally getting rid of the manufacturing was not a great idea, and that it might be quite hard to undo it.
Yeah, I think that some of them may be regretting that. And you'd see, like, even characters in this country, like Andrew Neil, will express that. The difference, to my mind, is that, like, they may well regret it now. They may well see it as a strategic error. But the way that capitalism is structured now, I doubt that they can actually reverse course, because to actually reverse the course and actually bring back, like, or recreate a manufacturing base in this country would take a really determined effort to go against what are fundamental interests of the British ruling class that have come to dominate since, well, they've developed over the course of 100 years, like the urge to deindustrialize, the urge to the imperative for the British ruling class to conduct all of its profiteering in the form of, like, the moving around of money. And not investing in this country, like, even David Cameron, like, clueless buffoon though he was, like, was trying to get the British ruling class to invest internally by throwing money at them, but they just sat on it all. And the investment rates for British capitalism remain exorably bad, and have done for over 10 years. So the politicians themselves may recognize it, but whether they can turn this, what I view, what me, myself and Layla have discussed this a lot, this idea that this is a 100-year process of progressive deindustrialization, and what I don't think that they can turn that around, no matter how much they may try. But I think this current generation of, like, state managers in British capitalism, and I think American capitalism, I don't think they're capable of making a turnaround on that. Layla, did you want to?
No, I mean, I think the only hope, really, yeah, is, like, I think the Soviet Union played such a big role, not just because, I mean, yes, because it did kind of provide this idea of communism, but the idea wasn't
just an inspiration for, that wasn't just a form of, it didn't just scare the bourgeoisie, it also inspired the proletariat. And whether or not that idea was close to reality is kind of besides the point, that, like, you know, your average Joe or Jane trade unionist used to, you know, like, cite the Bolsheviks and, you know, talk about the Soviet Union and, like, take that into account in their militancy. And it was like, the image that the Soviet Union had in Lenin was a huge inspiration for the working classes throughout the world. In Canada, for instance, like, you see the bourgeoisies earlier, bourgeoisies always, you know, accusing some random trade unionist of being a Bolshevik and a Red and stuff like that. So I think that is the true root of the dynamism in culture. I think it's this challenge from the working class against the bourgeoisie. And I think that the working classes, like, infuse a society with innovation. And that's why we saw this explosion in innovation and technology and everything during the kind of the USSR era. Like, there's a lot going on. It's not just the USSR. I think it was also, of course, like, the higher working class militancy, but these two things interact dialectically. So I think, I think my mind is that we're not really going to see a change until the working classes can reorganize themselves and, you know, mount that and reinsert the rationality into the system and reinsert innovation into the system. Until then, it's just going to be like postmodernism, which is just like an awkward pastiche of older forms, but married to, like, novel technologies, and kind of all, like, molded together uncomfortably in what ends up being a very obscene cultural expression, in my opinion. David Harvey has a great book about this, actually, The Condition of Postmodernity, where he goes through it in a lot of detail. And I agree with him on that book at that point, like, that postmodernism is this, like, weird, it's like kished. It's all just like this melding together of different cultures and different time eras in a way that deroots all these things from their original places and times, and just puts it all together in this, like, Frankenstein expression of art.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, the Soviet Union, of course, also gave money to, like, you know, all these, like, organizations around the world as well. I mean, I know there's a few in Ireland that were definitely getting money from the Soviet Union, and there's no equivalent of that. You know, if you were getting money from China now, the FBI would probably just arrest you immediately.
Yeah, and I think also, like, the USSR also did, for all of its faults, and this is something that Fisher mentions in his book, Capitalist Realism, it did provide spaces because it also needed to prove itself, right, to its own working classes. And it you know, I have a, you know, whatever your view is of the USSR, like, it did provide spaces and funding to artists in a way that was unprecedented for, you know, especially the Russian context or the Russian Empire context. And from that, a lot of innovation came that was then taken on and inspired American artists. Like, so the example that Fisher brings up is the innovation that the USSR did in terms of USSR artists did in terms of science fiction. And how, you know, the movie Stalker, for instance, by, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Tchaikovsky, yes, sorry. I'm so bad at pronouncing words of any kind, but especially Russian words. Like, that served as a direct inspiration for Blade Runner, for instance. Like, you can, and when you watch Stalker, it's uncanny. Like, it feels the same. Like, when you watch Stalker, it feels the same as when you start to, like, when you watch Blade Runner. So I there's, like, a lot of stuff going on in that era, which I don't think China, I mean, I just don't really see it coming from, like, this imperial competition between China and the United States for a variety of reasons. Yeah. Unfortunately, I wish that China was a worker state that was posing a challenge to American imperialism. But yeah, intellectual honesty leads me to the conclusion that's not the case.
Yeah, and, intellectual honesty doesn't lead to that Xi Jinping money.
Yeah, but I also wonder too if this is something I've heard some people talking about, this idea that if there are other powers, not just China, but maybe Russia or wherever else kind of emerges in the coming years, that even if they're not, even if they don't play that role that we just described, the very existence of them will create the potential for other forms of competition. Like, for example, remember I was saying how I was thinking they should move all the art to Russia or somewhere else. Obviously they're not going to do that, but it might be safer there. But, you know, what if another power emerged and like was able to just say, okay, if you're going to America, to the West, if you're going to, you know, destroy all of your great art and you're going to kick all of your interesting thinkers out of the institutions and you're going to fire all the scientists or that say the wrong thing, we'll take them. You know, like that could, something like that could happen, you know. And I wonder where that would be, you know, like a sort of, because it, again, like a Cold War, part of the Cold War soft power of America was like, we are the free country. We're the place where the dissidents of the world can come. And that kind of did happen to some extent. Like they, you know, were able to bring in all these people, and then it reinforces the soft power, because then you have dissidents from all over the world saying how terrible it was back home and how great America is, you know. But they were able to draw from that creativity, you know, in a way. So I wonder. But I think if another country did that, America would probably just use its military and financial power to terrorize them and bankrupt them.
My feeling is that this impulse to destroy art and denigrate beauty and things like that is a very petty bourgeois impulse. And actually, one thing I was reading is that a lot of museums are actually selling their pieces, and during the pandemic, because they were going bankrupt and stuff like that and becoming insolvent. Exactly. Yes. And I think it's the bourgeoisie. Like I think that they use the petty bourgeoisie. A good question. I'm not sure. I think it's a mix of both, actually. I think the bourgeois, like the bourgeois, like the proper bourgeois, like billionaire class and whatever, like they use the petty bourgeoisie like as a shock troops to control society, to enable exploitation of the working class. But I think for them, they don't necessarily care or believe in their own ideologies all the time. Like, you know what I mean? So I think the art will be preserved, but I think that the extracting that art and bringing it to the people was a success of the working classes. And now they're losing that as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah,
I remember coming across an article a long time ago. Well, maybe it was like a year or two ago, and it was about this kind of unsolved mystery of how Chinese artifacts in Western museums were being robbed. And like, it's very difficult to rob things from a museum, so they were, you know, there was like serious expertise in getting them out. But that was happening, and they don't know like where they went. So, I mean, there is a possibility that, I mean, I was thinking, like, is the Chinese government paying for like people to go and basically piece by piece rob all the Chinese ancient art that's in Western museums? Or similarly, like, what if these Western artworks are being bought up by all like Russian oligarchs or something, you know? But yeah, no, the tragedy of it is the fact that it was taken from the private sphere of like private collections and made accessible to the general public, you know. That's like one of the great achievements
of
humanity, actually, I think, in probably all of history.
I 100% agree, and I think it's an assault. It's an assault on the working classes to tear them away from what they helped create, which properly belongs to everyone. It really is, and it's weird to, like, I remember I went to Paris a few years ago, and I went to this area where they sold, like, ancient artifacts, like, from Africa and stuff, for, like, you know, tens of thousands of euros, and I was just like, it was so odd to see, like, because in my mind I was like, you can't sell this, like, this is an artifact. Like, it comes
from. That's where
you're
wrong.
Yeah, I know. And then I guess. And I guess actually, because I you know, mostly grew up in an era where that kind of was like, you know, when I grew up, it was kind of like a obvious thing that this kind of thing should be in a museum where everyone can come see it type thing, you know. And I think it's shifting away from that now. And I think the pandemic really accelerated that, where
we took so many things for granted. You know, exactly. It never occurred to me that art would be anywhere other than a museum, you know. I always thought that, you know, there would be just every decade will have its new kind of vibrant culture, and I never thought that it would just stop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I know we're getting to the 2-hour mark. I unfortunately have to get going myself. But maybe before I go, Alec, did you want to ask anything else, or Angela? Maybe round this off.
Well, I think we've been going for an hour and 55, so I think that's probably gone through most of what we wanted to ask. But I wanted to round off just by thanking you, Angela, for coming on, because it's been a really good discussion between us, and hopefully you have enjoyed it as well, and you'd agree to come back sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks. It's really interesting.
Yeah, thank you so much, Angela. And we're both looking forward to your Substack articles.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and so everyone should go check it out and subscribe if they haven't yet.
Before hysterical New York Times columnist gets Substack shut down.
Get it?
Well, yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Oh, I really hope that doesn't happen. Please let us have one small thing.
Oh, we'll all be going back to chain letters. That'll be the next thing.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that'll be nice, actually.
Yeah.
Back to nom de plume and just like handwritten letters, just like the Russian revolutionaries.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you so much. Angela.